Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait till you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Content warning. This episode contains discussion of the murder and sexual assault of a teenage girl.
Strange sounds rang through the August night, and their echoes linger to this day. A married couple living on Epworth Forest Road in North Webster, Indiana, first heard the noise over the chatter of their television set. It was August 6, 1975. A loud car blasted past their house. Something metallic slammed, possibly a car trunk. When the husband stepped outside, he saw a red-orange General Motors vehicle, one that looked like an Oldsmobile Cutlass, and a medium green Mustang. The Oldsmobile roared off. The witness thought it sounded loud by design. That same night, a woman living nearby also heard something. Several voices speaking the words, "Let's get," or "Let's get her." A loud car revved up, then drifted away. Those witnesses described what they heard to the Indiana State Police investigators digging into the abduction and murder of 17-year-old Laurel Jean Mitchell. She had been walking along Epworth Forest Road in North Webster, Indiana, away from her workplace at the Cokesbury Inn, a lakeside hall. That night, she had plans to meet her group of friends at the arcade at Adventureland, a nearby amusement park. She never arrived. The following morning, fishermen discovered her body floating in the Elkhart River in Indiana's Noble County. She had been sexually assaulted and forcibly drowned. Some sounds we can conjecture. The rush of the river, the splashing. Upon examining Laurel's body, Dr. P.L. Sankey concluded that the teenager had made a violent struggle to survive. Despite the heinous nature of the crimes, Laurel Mitchell's case went quiet for decades. Theories floated around, but no one was ever prosecuted. On January 31st and February 1st, 2023, The Murder Sheet released two episodes featuring an interview with Laurel's younger sister, Sarah, who has spent years advocating for her. We'll include links to our past coverage in the show notes to this episode, so you can catch up if you need to.
Less than a week after our interview with Sarah aired, things got loud again. On February 7, 2023, news broke that Indiana State Police, led by Captain Kevin Smith, had arrested Fred Bandy Jr. and John Wayne Lehman. ISP had been investigating them for years.
Through the publicly released probable cause affidavit, we were all able to read about what police believed happened to Laurel. Law enforcement alleges that Bandy and Lehman abducted her that night before sexually assaulting and drowning her. Police ultimately put together a case against the two men through tips from witnesses and DNA technology.
Lehman has a clean record, while Bandy was convicted for counts relating to child molestation over the years. The men have been charged with murder. They are innocent until proven guilty. The first pretrial hearing in the case is currently set for April 24th, 2023.
Poring over the affidavit so soon after interviewing Sarah was surreal. We could almost picture the dark street that Laurel walked along. We could almost hear the sounds that the witnesses noticed. But today, we're going to talk about a different kind of echo. We'll talk to one of Laurel's friends, one who was in the group that she was supposed to meet up with that night. We'll talk about how this case has lingered over the years for the people closest to Laurel, and how it has echoed across generations. My name is Anya Kane. I'm a journalist.
And I'm Kevin Greenlee. I'm an attorney.
We first connected while looking into the Burger Chef murders, an Indiana cold case. Together, we built a spreadsheet documenting hundreds of cases of restaurant-related homicides. That original spreadsheet gave way to our podcast, The Murder Sheet.
Now we maintain that same research-centric, investigative approach as we look into all sorts of homicides, including unsolved cases, historical crimes, and, of course, restaurant murders.
We don't just chat about the headlines. Our podcast is a platform for our journalism. The Murder Sheet focuses on investigative reporting, thoughtful analysis, thorough research, and in-depth interviews.
We're The Murder Sheet, and this is
Beyond the Pillars, The Murder of Laurel Jean Mitchell. Echoes.
Here's Laurel's close friend, Tony.
I grew up in North Webster. I never lived anywhere else until I was 18, or close to 18 anyway.
For Tony, the lakeside community of North Webster, Indiana, in Kosciuszko County, was more than just a hometown. Her family experienced a major tragedy there, one that fundamentally altered Tony's life. When she was just 7 years old, her mother was killed in a car accident. Until her father remarried, her grandparents took on raising Tony and her sisters. But others in North Webster also made a point of helping out.
All the women in the town that could pitch in and help with us basically did. And Wilma was one of the first ones I remember being that way.
Wilma Mitchell had three kids of her own with her husband Richard, or Dick. Daughters Laurel and Sarah, and a son. Tony and Laurel were about the same age and got to know each other even better through school.
Laurel and I were in the same class in school because of our last names being so close together in the alphabet. That's how you got put in your classes back then. And we were in the same kindergarten all the way through. I would even say most of our classes in high school were together. Until our junior year, and then Laurel was a lot smarter than I was as far as school was concerned.
Tony struggled in school, but she was able to make lasting friendships at a young age. She said she has Laurel to thank for that.
I feel fortunate. I grew up in a neighborhood where all of my friends lived in within a 4 or 5 block radius. And I still speak to many of them on a regular basis. And I think the reason that is because we were drawn together by Laurel. Even before she was taken from us, she was nice to everyone. Everyone thought she was their best friend. She made you feel that way.
Tony's first memories of Laurel reflect a rather dramatic moment from the kindergarten they both attended, which was run from the basement of the local Methodist church.
When we were in kindergarten, we were going up down the steps to go to kindergarten, and Laurel fell down the steps and broke her leg. And my dad carried her up the church steps and across the street to the doctor's office. And that was the day that, the first day I remember really knowing her well, and it just seemed like we were always friends after that.
Laurel became a friend Tony could always count on.
She was extremely smart. She was a well-organized person. And I say that she was very friendly, but I wouldn't say that she was overly trusting either. She was a good judge of character. She was good at giving you advice even at a young age. I used to have a piece of paper that had a Bible verse on it that was written in Laurel's handwriting, that I carried with me until the writing is no longer off. You can't read it. I still have the piece of paper, but the pencil is gone off of it. And I think she gave that to me when we were in the eighth grade. An old soul. That's a good way to describe her, an old soul. She took care of her sister. She was so caring and considerate to what she did, how it affected all of the people in her family. She had aspirations that she had set. She knew where she wanted to go to college before we started high school. I truly believe she would have gone to that college where she's still with us. And I think she would have been someone who made a place in many people's lives that she would be remembered for.
Tony said Laurel indicated that she wanted to earn her undergraduate degree from Indiana University. IU is a system of public universities in the Hoosier State, with a flagship campus in the city of Bloomington. Tony also recalled that Laurel was interested in a career in education, perhaps even ultimately becoming a college professor.
As we recapped in our earlier episodes about this case, Laurel was a spiritual person and a devout Methodist. She was very into participating in God's Children, a singing group run through her church. Tony told us that she never saw Laurel drink alcohol, and their friend group wasn't big into the partying scene.
It was clear from talking with Tony how important Laurel was to not only her, but their group of friends and the wider community of North Webster.
We next asked Tony to take us back to August 6, 1975. The night Laurel vanished.
Some background about the summer of 1975. Tony, Laurel, and their group of friends had all been seeing a lot of each other that summer. Laurel even had a friend from out of town staying with her family. Most of the girls held down summer jobs, but they also made plenty of time to hang out.
This is from my memory, and according to the rest of the girls, my memory. Some of them don't remember things, and they think that probably I'm remembering better than they do because I do have a pretty good memory. Mm-hmm. About this anyway, it's all like it. When I talk about it, it's like it just happened. And sorry.
It's okay.
We all, like I said, lived in a small neighborhood, maybe 4 or 5 blocks between all of us. You could just about go from yard to yard and be in one of our yards. We didn't hardly have to leave yards if we didn't want to. And we had 2 friends that were going to the county fair that night. And one of them decided that, you know, later in the day that she was going to go with them. So we made arrangements for another friend to pick Laurel up at work because those two were not going to be around, which we did that for each other. There were only two of them that had cars. So we tried to do that as much as we could for each other. Also, sometimes as a group, we would walk out there and get her from work and then walk back up to what everyone calls Adventureland now, but we never called it anything but the arcades. The friend that worked in another town, the store she worked at closed at 9 o'clock. And she said she would pick Laurel up from work and bring her to the arcades. That she would just hang out with her at work until she got off, which was normally 10 o'clock. And she went out there that night when she got off work, and the lights were off in Cokesbury. And Laurel was not there. So she just assumed that we had picked her up. We'd walked out there and gotten her, or she had walked up on her own. And this is something else you have to know about us. None of us hitchhiked alone. Well, all kids hitchhiked back then. All teenagers did. They just did. But we never got into a car alone with someone we didn't know. And there were always, we would always make sure there were at least two if we did it. And it didn't happen very often. That's another thing. Laurel had so much common sense. I think we all came from families that were taught that. So then the friend that was getting off work and went to get her and couldn't find her came to the arcades. And I honestly can't tell you exactly who I was with when she came. But it seems like there were three or four of us. And the two that were supposed to pick her up that had gone to the county fair may have already been there when our friend that worked got there. I can't tell you exactly how many of us there were there. I know I wasn't there alone. I wouldn't have walked out there alone. You had to walk past the graveyard, and I was a big chicken, which cracks me up now because I'm not really afraid of anything. And I think that comes somewhat from what happened then. Kind of takes the fear away.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
We wanted to interject here for a moment. We previously reported that Laurel's family, particularly her mother Wilma, felt understandably upset when it turned out that she hadn't received a ride to the arcade or Adventureland, and that nobody knew where she was. Something had gone very wrong, and the worst happened to Laurel. Those feelings are completely valid.
But we feel it's also worth stressing that if this all happened today, the teenagers would probably be able to coordinate transportation in a group chat and text or call one another if there was a misconnection. Laurel and her group of friends lacked such technology. This was 1975. There were no cell phones. Tony's family didn't even have a landline at their house at the time.
So in a scenario where Laurel and her friend just missed each other, there was no way to rectify that issue unless they happened to cross paths again. We also feel this situation was exacerbated by the following facts that would have probably been innocuous on any other night. The initial plans changed, and different factions of the group split up to go to the fair and the arcade. Uncertainty would have colored everything because nobody had any means of directly contacting one another. That means that one friend or portion of the group of friends being unable to find Laurel could also just indicate that she had changed her mind and grabbed a ride with the other group. Let's also not forget that we are talking about North Webster, a safe place. Tony described it as a real-life Mayberry, the charming and friendly fictional small town from the Andy Griffith Show. Our understanding is that Laurel walking to Adventureland would have been a minor inconvenience that would have hardly been worth mentioning later, had the worst not happened before she reached safety. This is completely on us, but I will say I don't feel we properly expanded on those points in our previous coverage of this case.
We think it's very important to emphasize all of this because the blame for what happened to Laurel lies with those who killed her. The two men, Fred Bandy Jr. and John Wayne Lehman, who have been charged with her murder, are innocent until proven guilty, of course. If they plead guilty or stand trial and get convicted, then the evidence spelled out in the probable cause affidavit for their arrest indicates that Laurel was a victim of opportunistic predators that put their own sexual satisfaction above the life of a young girl.
The fault is with Laurel's killers, not with her friends.
Now, let's get back to Tony's account of what happened next.
We had one friend that was staying with her at her house. Was the only one we weren't accounted for. And so we kind of all thought maybe she was just with her. So I think it was probably around 11 o'clock we decided we were going to find that out. And we split up into some groups. And I think someone went to Laurel's house to see if that friend that was staying with her and Laurel were there. I don't know who went there.
Tony said she went home. There, she told the woman who would later become her stepmother what was happening. Laurel was missing, and the friend group was attempting to find her. Her future stepmother ordered her to stay at home while she went to pick up Tony's father.
But outside, in the dark of night, Tony's friends were still looking for Laurel. Around midnight, the Mitchells also became concerned. The friend who was staying with the Mitchells arrived home without Laurel and with no news about her whereabouts. As Sarah, Laurel's younger sister, previously described in our episode, their father, Dick Mitchell, drove around the Epworth Forest area near Laurel's workplace. He illuminated the dark roads with his headlights to see if he could find his daughter. Police were also notified about the missing teenager.
Then I got up the next morning and went to work, and I worked at the local ladies' clothing store with one of our other friends in our group. And we were at work, and we were standing at the front counter talking about it, and the friends that went to the county fair came around the corner with one of their boyfriend's cars, pulled in, and one of them got out screaming, "She's dead, she's dead." And the lady that owned the store took all of us into the back room. The next thing I remember, I was in the bathroom on somebody's lap, vomiting into the toilet. So I have a short period there where I have no memory. And then they sent us all home, and we all went to one house, but I can't tell you where we all went. Then I guess, I can't remember if the police came to get us or if they called us, but they didn't bother with parents being with us. They took us in two at a time and talked to us.
Authorities from the Indiana State Police and the Kosciuszko County Sheriff's Office were there, along with Northwestern Marshal Tony Strombeck. Strombeck knew Tony. She said that her father later claimed to have named her after the marshal. In our previous episodes, we mentioned him as being quoted in news coverage of a serial rapist who terrorized Northwestern and nearby towns. As a side note, Tony explained that that predator had actually been caught before Laurel's murder. Anyways, Marshal Strombeck was a longtime local official who, by all accounts, out of the folks we've spoken to from Northwestern, was dedicated to his community.
But in that room, he was not in charge. Police had pieced together that Laurel had likely been abducted in Northwestern in Kosciuszko County and then transported to Noble County, where she was drowned. This was now a homicide investigation that crossed county lines. Tony doesn't remember if state police or county investigators took the lead. She said she didn't even consider the implications of the detectives wanting to talk to the teenagers all without their parents present. She and her friends didn't care. They just wanted to help.
They kept trying to say that they knew Laurel had a boyfriend and we were just covering up for her. And it was okay now to say that she had made plans to meet her boyfriend, and none of that was true. Never even. And I understand now as an adult, that was just them trying to get a clue. But in that situation, none of us would have lied to them about where we thought someone was. Even when we thought she was missing, we would not have lied about that. We would have told them everything we knew.
Despite the intense questioning, Tony and her friend tried to tell the police what they knew. They said that Laurel didn't have a secret boyfriend. She was single. Then at some point, Tony said the detectives pulled out crime scene photographs. Tony looked at the pictures. She saw her friend lying dead on the bank of the Elkhart River. She saw Laurel's sweatshirt had been zipped up inside out.
I don't know if they showed everyone the pictures. But I know the girl and they took in with me. They showed us the pictures. They asked us some questions. And then the guy that was the town marshal told them that was enough and let us go home. And the next time they tried to come and talk to one of us, they went across the street from me. And that dad there said, "You were completely out of line with what you did. And you're not talking to our kids anymore right now. Give them some time." This was all within hours of us finding out.
Tony told us that she understands that the detectives were trying to get answers. But in our view, those are harsh tactics to apply to a group of teenagers still reeling from losing a friend. Remember, this all happened in the span of just a few hours.
Before Laurel's death, Tony had considered herself a bit of a true crime buff. As a little girl, she recalled sitting on her grandfather's lap as he perused true crime magazines, reading along with him. But however frightening or gruesome those stories were, they were ultimately words on a page. Nothing could have prepared her for the murder of her close friend. For Tony and her friends, the murder of Laurel represented a loss of feeling truly safe, the end of innocence.
The lady that we all worked for at the ladies' clothing store made the comment afterwards that we didn't have the innocence look in our eyes anymore. It was gone.
At times, some members of the friend group experimented with drinking or other unhealthy coping mechanisms.
I think that we were more, I don't know, it's almost like we lost our center post, you know what I mean?
Remember that Tony and Laurel's other friends were the same age as her. As far as they knew, an unknown killer had done this horrible thing to their friend. Then for years, the murderer or murderers had gotten away with it. We imagine that prompted frightening queries. Who could have possibly done this? And what if they returned to take someone else?
We had no clue. I mean, a lot of people brought names up and we said, oh, no, it's not them. Oh, no, it's not them. Oh, it couldn't be them. It couldn't be them. That's crazy. That's not them. But to say we had somebody we thought, no.
Tony said that the members of the group are all functioning adults now and ultimately move forward by relying on one another. But the survivor's guilt could be difficult to deal with. Tony often found herself returning to one heartbreaking question.
If something like that had to happen, why did it have to be the best person you ever knew? You know, I would have been a better choice. I had a crappy life. She deserved to live the fullest life she could. She deserved it far more than I did. That's how I felt as a kid.
Tony went on to raise two children of her own, a daughter, Miranda, and a younger son. Tony told us that she believes what happened to Laurel influenced her own parenting style.
I probably was a little overcautious. Miranda will tell you that she could not pull the wool over my eyes easily. And I think that was because I learned to be more cautious about a lot of things after that. When my kids were old enough to drive, if they were not at home and I heard sirens, I was in a panic because I needed to know where they were at. And they needed to get to a phone and call me.
Tony ensured that Laurel became a part of her kids' lives, just like all of her other lifelong friends.
My kids knew about her from day one. I don't believe in keeping secrets from kids.
We have interviewed many, many people whose lives were forever changed by violent crimes, like murders. Losing somebody you care about in a sudden, violent manner inflicts trauma. That trauma isn't necessarily something neat that you can fold up and tuck away. It spills over into your life in ways obvious and subtle. Sometimes it can even be passed down through generations.
In this case, we were curious to learn more about how Laurel's life and death continued to impact those who cared about her and their families.
So we interviewed Tony's daughter, Miranda, for the program. She actually got in touch with us in the first place. She explained her connection to the crime and how it's been something her mother has lived with since 1975. And in a way, it's something that she's lived with for her entire life. Here's Miranda.
I am the daughter of one of Laurel's friends that she was supposed to meet the night that she was taken and murdered. I grew up in the North Webster area.
You never met Laurel, but she had a huge impact on your life. Can you tell us when you first remember hearing about her story?
I honestly don't ever remember not hearing about it. She was just someone that my mom always talked about. What happened to her was always talked about. It was never an unknown that I can remember, so.
As a young child, hearing about a story so awful happening to another young girl, essentially, how did that scare you? What were your feelings about it as a kid?
I don't remember ever feeling like it impacted me in that way until I was a teenager. And I would say probably once my mom sat me down and had the conversation with me, like, it's super important that you, if you leave with your friends, you come back with your friends. If you guys go somewhere together, you stay together. Stick with the plan. And if the plan changes, everyone's parents need to know. And you all need to meet up or make contact with each other again. And so when she, you know, kind of sat me down and explained that to me, then the questions of, well, why are you like that? Why is that so important? Mom, it's not a big deal, right? And then she got more into the details and kind of, you know, the tragedy and the trauma and the way that it impacted her whole life and, you know, the group of friends that she still has to this day. And I can remember at that point, like, okay, now it makes sense.
Tell me more about that. Did you notice, and at that point, did you realize that she was a very protective parent in other ways that you hadn't really picked up upon before?
Maybe it more was a thing of, as an adult then, looking back, it made sense to me then. I don't have children of my own, I do have a brother that's about 9 years younger than me. And so things that my mom did, I noticed myself, you know, making sure that he knew those things too. So.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
But in many ways, Laurel's presence in Miranda's life was like that of her mom's other close friends.
You know your mom's friends, right? But Laurel mm-hmm. is sort of a friend who you never got to meet, but you still knew her to a certain extent through your mom. And, mm-hmm. you know, can you tell us a bit more about that experience and also what you learned about Laurel as a person from your mom?
So I would say that even though Laurel was gone, it didn't feel like, honestly, any different than any of my mom's other girlfriends from, you know, that time period that she's still friends with now, because many of them didn't live in Indiana anymore. They moved away and they would come into town occasionally and we would see them. So it almost kind of just felt like she was that friend that moved away. And while, you know, I knew that her life had been taken, it still kind of always felt that way because of the way that my mom talked about her and because of the way that the other girls talked about her. So it wasn't always a thing of our friend Laurel that got murdered. It was our friend Laurel. She was a kind person. She was a happy person. She loved everything that we were involved in church. We had a lot of fun together. We were in the same class since kindergarten. You know, fond memories of a great friend and a great human. And I think that probably more than, you know, just my mom, us girls that, and probably the boys too, but especially my mom's one friend that has a daughter my age, I think that our moms did a really good job of making sure that we knew the best parts of Laurel and tried to help us be that way. And the importance of kindness and the importance of being a good human.
Growing up, Miranda also began to see how the memory of Laurel's abduction and murder echoed through the North Webster community.
My grandparents and my great-grandparents lived in North Webster when I was growing up. And, you know, it was a part of our normal routines. If we wanted to go to their house, we went to their house and we could walk around town. We just had our check-in times with, I think everybody from North Webster would say their check-in times were the noon whistle. I say that, but then in the same token, I think that the looming unknown of what happened to Laurel definitely was there. And I would say that, you know, obviously my parents and my grandparents weren't as lax as maybe my grandparents were with my mom, you know, in that generation.
It seems to maybe have quietly changed the town in terms of how it thought about those things.
Sure, sure. And I would say too, like to add to that, I don't even know that you would put it in the category of quietly doing it. I mean, it was something that was always talked about. And when people found out who my mom was, you know, they looked at me with, I want to say an eyebrow raise, but I don't mean that in like in a negative connotation. I mean it in, oh, your mom was one of Laurel's friends, if that makes sense.
As Miranda grew older, she learned more details about the circumstances of Laurel's murder.
When your mom's talking to you candidly about, okay, now you're a teenager, I can tell you about some of the, you know, traumatic things that happened. What do you remember about that conversation? Was it one conversation or was it sort of a dialogue that started around that time in your life?
I would say it was definitely a dialogue that started at that time in my life. And obviously, as I got older and matured, maybe she shared more information with me than like harder details. She maybe shared those with me as time went on. And like I said, as I matured, she, you know, it was always the same thing that, you know, her friend was taken. And the whole story that she always told me was they had a game plan before everyone went to work and went on with their plans for that evening. And part of the group changed their plans and decided to go to the county fair. And the other part of the group stayed at Adventureland and made plans for one of the other gals to pick Laurel up. And when she went to pick Laurel up, she was already gone. And I believe now, having, you know, seen the probable cause affidavit, that, I mean, they missed each other by seconds. And just how quickly it went from we can't find Laurel to she's dead. And she was brutally murdered and sexually assaulted. There is no rhyme or reason to it. Can you imagine being a teenager and this happening to you and your group of friends? And over the course of 47 years, you go through this scenario over and over again, thinking like, could we have done something different? What could we have done different? And for me, my hope is there is nothing that could have been done differently. And these were just bad guys.
We asked Miranda how this tragedy affected her mom over the years.
I think if you would have asked me this question, I mean, even last week prior to Tuesday and the news of the arrest being made, I would have had one answer. And since the arrests have been made, I feel like probably my answer has changed. For the most part, the blanket statement would be, how could this not affect her, right? Mm-hmm. How could this not be detrimental to such a young age and at such a pivotal age in your life? How could it not change the course of your life? But I think the biggest picture for me now is, and I don't want this to sound like a selfish statement, and so I don't even want to just make it about my mom, but about Sarah and Laurel's brother, anyone that was impacted by this, like everyone's lives were changed. Everyone lost a part of themselves that day that happened. And some people got stuck at that age. And I truly believe that my mom, especially, like, as much as she did a great job protecting us and preparing us for the unknown, part of her was still stuck at a 17-year-old kid, you know, that had the worst case scenario happen to her best friend. And knowing that now and knowing that these two men have been arrested, it angers me. I'm mad. How much of this robbed Sarah and Laurel's brother, Dick and, you know, Miss Wilma and the North Webster community, my mom and her friends, and then us kids. They were stuck on that day in some aspect of their life. And so did we get cheated from something, if that makes any sense.
What Miranda aptly described is absolutely a reality for many people dealing with trauma. A person who's experienced trauma can experience arrested emotional or psychological development. To a certain degree, they can get stuck at the age where they experience said trauma. Not necessarily across the board, but in certain aspects of their life.
For her part, Miranda became increasingly interested in the then unsolved, seemingly cold case. You have been doing some research on this case for a number of years now, as I understand it. Can you talk me through, you know, transitioning from having this be, you know, a reality in your life and your family's life, to maybe deciding I would like to know more and maybe look a bit into this myself?
Sure. My senior year of high school, I also went to Wallasey and graduated from there. My senior year of high school, I had an English teacher that assigned us these, you know, that was back when like NCIS and like all these like crime and punishment TV shows were on TV, right? And he assigned us, because we kind of had a rough class, he assigned us something that had our interest, and he assigned us these reports to do that were crime and punishment. And one of the kids in my class was also part of the North Webster group and impacted his dad's life. And so he and I went to our teacher and said, hey, we would really like to do something that hits a little more close to home. Unfortunately, we don't have a period at the end of the statement, like this crime happened, period. Right now it's a comma. And how can we do this project and how do we transition that, right? So we just started digging in with anything that we could find. We went to the library, we sat in front of, you know, the machine that brings up the newspaper articles, and we went through those, and it was super emotional. I think at that point, it made me understand my mom. It made me understand, you know, her girlfriends that had kids my age. It made me understand, like, some of her parenting, the way she did things. And for lack of a better term, once I sat down and did that, I needed my mom to have peace. If I could just take a little bit of my own time and give these girls and these families and this community, like, not that I was like trying to be the detective that like solved the case, but did someone miss something? And I, you know, I would put the case on the shelf, and every few years would get it out and ask questions and write notes. I mean, I have a tote of articles and notes and things I printed off of the internet and just all the things. And I think I was just searching for my mom and her friends to have peace.
Miranda first reached out to us before the arrests, after she heard our two episodes on Laurel's case. We were struck by how informed she was about the crime, and we were very interested in her perspective as somebody who grew up in the shadow of a cold case. We were going to interview her about that. Then the big news came in on February 7th, 2023. Authorities had just arrested John Wayne Lehman and Fred Bandy Jr. for Laurel's murder. Miranda was the first person to email us about the massive update.
We asked her to recount that day for us.
You know, where were you when you heard this, and what was your reaction? And talk me through that.
Yeah, so I was at work getting ready to start my day, doing some behind the scenes paperwork. I'd just been on the phone with my mom maybe 15 minutes before that, and my phone rang again, and it was her. And I was getting ready to start a haircut with a client, and she was very upset. And she says, "Miranda, they arrested two people." And I said, "What are you talking about?" And the more she talked, the more upset she got. And I was like, "You have to stop and tell me what you're talking about." And she said, "They arrested two men for Laurel's murder." And my gut reaction was, this podcast had, you know, these episodes had just came out last week. Somebody is playing a mean, mean trick on my mom. And I said, "Who told you this?" And she said, "Miranda, it's in the news. Like, I got a phone call and then I saw it with my own two eyes. It's real. It's really happening. It's finally happening." I just said, "I'll be there as soon as I can. Bye." Hung up the phone with her and I couldn't talk. I couldn't do anything but stand and shake. And to even tell you the emotions that I had at that point, I just felt like, am I in a dream? As like cliche as that sounds. I called a close friend of mine. He and I have always kind of talked about this case and always worked together on finding out as much as we could. I called him immediately and I was like, "Where are you? And why didn't you call me?" Because typically he would be more privy to this information before I would. And he was like, "What are you talking about?" And I said, "They arrested two people for Laurel's murder." And it was radio silence on the phone. He very much had the same reaction that I did. And he said, "I'll be at the, you know, I work at a salon," and he said, "I'll be at the salon as soon as I can get there." And we got off the phone. I had to get through a haircut. I tried to call you. And then when you called me back, I think we both, like, at that point, the celebration started. And to know that the bad guys are in jail, you know, it just seems like the rest of the week has been such a whirlwind.
Talk me through the emotions you've felt since hearing the news.
You know, the first emotions obviously were shock. And I think Sarah, on the interview that you guys did with her on the third episode that you released, she did such a great job of verbalizing how she was feeling. And, you know, even being this far on the outside, I feel like for me, very much the same emotions. I think my number one feeling was, I need to get to my mom. I need to know that she's okay, and I need to see her with my own two eyes. And then just being thankful, because my mom just recently moved back to Indiana from Florida, and knowing that she was here with us and that we could be here to support her, I was super thankful for that. Now going forward, I'm angry. I'm angry. I'm sad. I'm confused. And anger is not an emotion that I sit with for long or sit with well. And it seems to be one that I just cannot shake. And that's really hard.
I mean, obviously, there's no good reason to murder anybody ever. But
right.
When you're reading about what happened to Laurel and seeing that it's one of the alleged perpetrators is somebody who's been accused of victimizing other children, and, mm-hmm. you know, you consider the circumstances of her death and, you know, what a wonderful person she was and how needlessly she was ripped away from her family, her friends, how traumatic this has been for everybody. It just seems like two predators, you know, trading a young girl's life so they can have sexual gratification for a few seconds is just.
And that's so, like, I mean, you hit the nail on the head, and it's just so hard to wrap your head around that. I think that's been my whole thing over the course of the last, you know, almost week, is that I just can't wrap my head around it. It just feels so surreal. Again, I'm super thankful for the work that law enforcement did, and somehow it, you know, all the years of thinking, like, did somebody mess up their job or could somebody have just done better? All of that, you know, those feelings are completely out the door. And knowing that the ISP officer, Smith, did all he did and the emotions that he's sitting with. And you don't want to, you know, you don't want to be selfish, but you still have all these big feelings. So it's hard.
Yeah, I imagine. And I don't think it's selfish given how much this impacted your family, but just also, you know, you're an empathetic person and you're looking at how much it affected everybody. And like, it was just needless. Like, it was just a horrific,
yeah.
You know, just awful. It makes me really angry too. And I did not live with it for years. It's just a case that we started reporting on. And I mean, candidly, when we were working on that episode and just kind of putting out the initial interview with Sarah, I kind of was worried that I like sounded too happy or like too much not the objective reporter. But
I think that the celebration in your voice, though, for me, captured like exactly how I felt when you and I spoke on the phone later that day. You know what I mean? Like, it was, you have to celebrate something. You have to find the silver lining in this, right? So let's celebrate that there's two bad, really, really bad human beings behind bars. And I think that you should not feel that way at all, because it definitely is something that let's find the positive in it and let's celebrate.
Yeah. And we're never going to be, I was thinking about it. I was like, we're never going to be objective about murder, you know,
right.
We're not going to be, both sides. We're going to be
but
very,
you could have been,
right.
But you could have been. And I'm thankful that you weren't. I'm thankful that, like, to know that you are, you know, you and Kevin are as invested as you are, and to hear the excitement in your voice somehow gave me permission to feel a little bit excited too.
Well, I really appreciate that. Now, Miranda wants to follow the case closely as it goes through the criminal justice system. In terms of the trial, or at least the adjudication of this case, you know, if they plea out, then it won't go to trial, but if they don't, then it will. What sort of answers do you want about what happened to Laurel, the circumstances of her murder?
The answers that I would want are anything that's going to bring, like, any bit of information that the alleged killers, if you will, any information that they'll bring that will bring peace to Laurel's family and the community. I think I just want that. I just want to know. I mean, I don't want to put expectations on two people who don't have the same heart that I do, because I'm going to be let down. And I think the community as a whole will be. But my hope in this is that everyone can just find a bit of peace, and that somehow, some way, these men will be willing to give that information. That's the least that they can do for what they've taken. But I think that's my biggest thing is, like, I just want people to be hopeful and find peace.
Miranda's questions are reasonable, but given the brutality of this crime, we imagine satisfactory answers may remain elusive.
Is there anything else you wanted to talk to us about this case, about how this sort of generational trauma impacted you growing up or to this day, or just any other thoughts or topics you wanted to kind of delve into?
You know, the only thing that I would have left to say is that the reason I wanted to do this interview, and I truly went back and forth on it, but it really did impact so many people in such a wide, you know, if you have a bullseye and Laurel's, the awful things that happened to Laurel is the center, and then there's the circles all the way around it. Well, my life is on the outside of that bullseye, and the North Webster community is on the outside of that bullseye, and anyone else that was impacted by this, we're still on the same bullseye board. And I think that for whatever reason, I just feel like it's important for people to know that, like, when things like this happen, it's not just a victim. It's not just the victim's family. It's not just the friends. It's, like you said, it's generationally, and it truly, the trauma truly impacts everyone. And in this case alone, I mean, it just, you can't be in this area and not know about Laurel and not, your heart not go out to her brother and sister, you know? It's so much bigger than just a victim.
Miranda was the one to encourage Tony to speak with us about her experience. We asked Tony how she first heard about the news of the break in Laurel's case.
A good friend of mine from high school called me and said, "Listen, what are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm sitting in my chair crocheting." He goes, "You're not watching TV?" I said, "I don't watch TV, remember?" He goes, "Oh, yeah." He goes, "What are you doing?" I go, "Listening to a podcast, what I always do." And he said, "Okay, well, I have something to tell you." And I didn't want you to see it on the news or see it on Facebook. And he said that he saw it on the news. And he said, "I'm sorry, I should have kept my mouth shut, I guess." I said, "Oh my God, no, I'm so glad I didn't open Facebook and see that on there. I think that would have been hard to take."
When Tony first heard the news about the arrest, she told us she felt a bit mixed up. She was scared that the killers would turn out to have been people she knew.
That was one of my things over all these years. Am I walking around talking to these people that did something like that to my friend? Of course, when you have children, that's another thing. Is this someone who is watching my children too now?
But Tony did not know Bandy or Lehman. She did not recognize the old men in the mugshots. Tony has since seen photographs purportedly of both men when they were younger. She said the picture of a young Bandy looked slightly familiar, but she did not know him.
Shortly after hearing the news, Tony thought she wanted to go to the spot where Laurel had been found. She had never been there before, although Miranda had visited the place. Mother and daughter started to drive to the river, but the closer they got, the more nervous Tony became. She ultimately told Miranda that she didn't want to go down to the river. There was no traffic, so they stopped the car in the road, right near the water where Laurel had been found years ago. They could see a gravel parking area and a boat ramp. They paused for a moment, then turned around and drove away. Afterwards, Tony left flowers on Laurel's grave.
Questions linger in Tony's mind. The probable cause affidavit for the arrest of Bandy and Lehman give indications of what the police think happened to Laurel. Like her daughter, Tony wants to know why this murder happened. The fact that Bandy accrued child molestation convictions over the years, that he was free to terrorize others, horrifies her.
Still, the news of the arrest has meant something to Tony.
I told Miranda, I think I've taken the first deep breath I've taken in 48 years when I found out that they arrested two men and that they had the, even if these guys don't get convicted, I truly believe this is what happened. And that gives me some breathing space, I guess.
She does acknowledge that there are likely things she will never know about her friend's murder.
There were 10,000 more questions that I know I can't ever get an answer to. I mean, unless these guys give a detailed confession and somebody puts it out where we can read it, I'm never going to know.
Gazing at the wizened faces of the accused men, Tony also said she reflected on the profoundly unfair nature of the murder.
I mean, they got most of their life out in the world, whether they had good life or bad life, at least they got a life. That's more than they gave Laurel. She deserved to have a life.
In the course of our interview with Tony, we circled back to something she had said earlier. She had revealed that, in the dark moments in the wake of Laurel's murder, she had questioned why her dear friend, the smart one, the kind one, the one who had so much going for her, had been murdered. Tony said that when she was younger, she had at times wished that she had been taken instead. That struck us as such a raw and deeply sad thought for one so young to have.
Through talking with Tony and Miranda, it seemed to us that Tony ultimately found a way to emerge from that darkness. She channeled the hurt into a purpose. The pride with which she spoke of both her children was palpable.
I have two children that are functioning adults and a family full of alcoholics and drug addicts and broken homes. And I got those two kids, and they had to live with divorced parents, you know, and they still turned out to be fantastic kids.
Today, Miranda is protective of her mother as well. They share a strong bond. Here's Tony.
She has so much more common sense than I do. Much more life savvy, I guess. And she's worked hard for it. She's a pretty thorough girl. Well, she has a tendency to be able to say what she thinks far more clearly and eloquently than I do. Of course, she's been that way since she learned to talk.
As we mentioned, Miranda was the one who encouraged Tony to talk to us. She thought it would be cathartic for her mother to share her story, for them to both talk about the lingering echoes of this brutal crime.
I did want to say to you that I appreciate that you are going at this from the perspective of what it does to the generations, that this isn't just something that happened to Laurel's parents and her sister and her brother. It happened to her nieces and nephews. It happened to her sister-in-law. It happened to her brother-in-law. It happened to every one of us kids that were close to her. It happened to our kids. People don't realize that that's the way it is. And we need to pay more attention to this. What happens now, how it affects the generations.
Laurel has never left Tony, not really. This remarkable young woman had such an impact on her friends that they raised a generation of children to get to know Laurel, at least on some level, even if they never got to meet her. Miranda spoke to that, as did Tony. We ended our conversation by asking Tony a question. If she could talk to Laurel one more time, what would she say? This is how Tony responded.
Thank you. Thank you for being my friend at times when I don't know why you did.
We want to profusely thank both Tony and Miranda for trusting us with their stories. We are very grateful to them for that.
We are also thankful to have met amazing people like Sarah, Laurel's sister, as well as Tony and Miranda through this case. We only wish that it wasn't under such tragic circumstances.
Thanks so much for listening to The Murder Sheet. If you have a tip concerning one of the cases we cover, please email us at murdersheet@gmail.com. If you have actionable information about an unsolved crime, please report it to the appropriate authorities.
If you're interested in joining our Patreon, that's available at www.patreon.com/murdersheet. If you want to tip us a bit of money for records requests, you can do so at www.buymeacoffee.com/murdersheet. We very much appreciate any support.
Special thanks to Kevin Tyler Greenlee, who composed the music for The Murder Sheet, and who you can find on the web at kevintg.com.
If you're looking to talk with other listeners about a case we've covered, you can join the Murder Sheet discussion group on Facebook. We mostly focus our time on research and reporting, so we're not on social media much.
We do try to check our email account, but we ask for patience as we often receive a lot of messages. Thanks again for listening.